This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. I'm here with Alan, as ever. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm great, thank you very much, Parv. We're on episode 15 now of Letters from Kayfabe, and we had a really interesting show last week. Anyone who hasn't listened, we had Chris Hero on, and we've got quite a lot of feedback about that show, and the timing for it was quite interesting, wasn't it, Parv?
Yeah, timing was very interesting, and thank you for everybody who listened. And if you were a first-time listener, go and check out our archives if you like what you heard. And thanks a lot again to Chris Hero for coming on.
Yes, thank you very much, Chris, and we wish you good luck in all your future endeavours.
So, shall we hit the sack? Oh, there's been a few changes to the sack, hasn't there, Alan? Do you want to talk about that first?
Yeah, slight changes to the sack. I mean, it's bulging, but we want the sack to be even fuller. We want it brimming. We want it spilling out. So to do that, if you want to ask questions, the best way to do that now, there's two ways. We've got quite a few listeners who aren't using Twitter, who aren't using Pro Wrestling Only. Silly people, but there we go. But those people as well, they can email us. They can write in at lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com. And if you just send your questions in that way, and also if you just use the hashtag, Letters from Kayfabe, it makes it a hell of a lot easier for me to find the questions on Twitter. So they're the best two ways of really getting hold of us. But you can also ask questions on the Pro Wrestling Only forum. In the publication section, we've got a thread going there as well. So if you want to get the sack bulging even more, that's the best way to do it.
You can even ask questions if you want on Kayfabe Memories.
Hi, guys.
So without further ado, why don't you go to the mailbag?
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Right, so the first question we've got is, Dear Alan and Parv, why was Bertha Fay brought into the WWF in 1995? Did Vince see money in her or just someone to add to the women's division? And that's from Mendoziak11 on Twitter. So Bertha Fay, the main squeeze of Harvey Whippleman, someone who came in 95 in around the summertime. So what do we know about Bertha Fay? You've watched some kind of the stuff, you know, in this short run, and what was your take takeaways from this?
Well, I think my ultimate takeaway is that Vince McMahon has got a fetish for putting large women into polka dots and then making fun of them. That's basically all I've got. Like, that's mainly what I got from watching the Bertha Fay stuff, is that I think that this was mainly to satiate some sick desire on Vince's part to fat shame. And I don't know any other. I mean, like, the angle with if people don't know, Bertha Fay was this large kind of middle-aged looking woman with big hair. Do you think that's fair? She was big and she had big hair, and she was kind of made to look a bit kind of trailer parky, and she wore loud kind of hearts and polka dots, and she was in love with Harvey Whippleman, who of course is a little pipsqueak. So the visual, like, she kind of grabs him and kind of manhandles him, and it's all a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it's I mean, she was someone who had quite a lot of success before this run in 95. Before then, she was working in Japan predominantly in the 80s. She started really early. I think she was about 19 when she got her first tour in All Japan Women, and she was given a push straight away, and she was given the WWA World Heavyweight title. She had two runs with that, and then she bounced around in Japan. She did some stuff in Puerto Rico, some stuff in Mexico, and also in Calgary. So in Calgary, she was kind of paired up with the other Sings. I mean, her name's Rhonda Singh, without the H. It's just S-I-N-G. But she put the H on the end of her name, and she was kind of paired up with people like Gamma Singh and people like that. So yeah, she was brought in 95. And when she was first brought in, she attacked Alondra Blaze on an edition of Raw on April the 3rd. She just regained the title from Bull Nakano, who'd finished up then in the WWF and went back to Japan. So this is when he needed the division to have another heel to chase Alondra Blaze. But the problem with the division at this time was there was only two people ever in the division. It was Alondra Blaze and an opponent. There was never really any undercard at all, anyone else. So it was really a poor division in, you know, looking back now. It ran from, what, 93 to 95. And it was just a vehicle for Alondra Blaze. And it was never really had any legs because there was no major talent, you know, brought in to kind of face her apart from the one person at a time. No one was built up on the undercard to get familiar, you know, with the audience. So she was brought in and she attacked Alondra Blaze and she seemed to break Alondra Blaze's nose during an angle. And at that point, she was wearing different kind of an outfit than what she was wearing later on when she started wrestling. She was dressed all in black. So she was brought in more as a kind of monster heel. But yeah, straight away, that was changed up. And then when she kind of made her wrestling debut, she was dressed, as you said, Parv, in kind of polka dots, bright colors, big hair. And she was positioned as this kind of trailer park type woman that Harvey Whippleman fell in love with and managed. And that kind of, this run went on for a couple of months. I think she beat Alondra Blaze at SummerSlam for the title, and she held it for a couple of months, and she dropped it again on Raw on October the 23rd. She wasn't too happy with the direction she was in. She was portrayed as a joke, so she kind of left the company not long after that. So there's not really any major moments because, as I said, the division was so small, so she didn't work anyone else really apart from Alondra Blaze. So there's not really much to add from my point of view about her WWF run. Is there anything else that you can kind of think of, Parv, that stands out to you?
Well, I mean, it kind of boggles my mind how a female wrestler even made a living at this time. It's just like, who does she... If you look at her results, she worked basically Alondra Blaze over and over and over again, just jobbing around the horn on house shows. And that one title change, like you said. I watched one match with her against Jessica Rivera, who is so obscure, she doesn't even have a link. You know, like, to get someone who's not linked on these databases is rare. I mean, Kelly, who I present Titans Wrestling with, he gets really excited if we ever come across a jobber who's just, like, so obscure they don't have any information on them. Like, who was the woman who she beat? Like, who knows? I mean, that's...
Yeah, well, there was the other one as well. There was another woman as well, the Pantera Serena.
Pantera Serena. And it's just like... I find it really fascinating in a way. This kind of... Like, there was obviously the... and maybe we'll talk about her on a later show, Fabulous Moolah, and her kind of reign of terror over the women's wrestling scene. But then you have, like, this weird period here... Before, like, divas were a thing, after Moolah's time had kind of done, and it's just
after, like, Moolah and Sherry Martel, and this was before Sonny, Sable, people like that.
So this is just kind of like probably like the absolute lowest point ever of women's wrestling. If you're one of these women, how do you get enough gigs to build up enough money to live? I just don't understand it. And here, Alondra Blaze is basically the champion. Like, she the champion of? She's the champion, literally, of just beating Bertha Faye over and over again. It's just like, what does it even mean to be the women's champion? So it just boggles my mind. So.
Yeah, I mean, the one good thing, though, there was a little kind of glimmer of hope later on in 95 when they brought in the All Japan Women for Survivor Series, that elimination match. So they had Aja Kong, Bertha Faye, Lioness Asuka, and... Tamaka Wannabe versus Alondra Blaze, Chaparita, the Queen of the Sky Twister Press, Kyoko Inoue, and Hasegawa. That was a really good match. I loved that at the time. And then there was a taping afterwards with Aja Kong on Raw, which was kind of really wild to see. Backfisting Asari. That was awesome. But yeah, apart from that, the division really didn't do anything at all. But after this, she went to WCW. She had a brief stint in WCW in 99 that people may not remember, where she was actually wacky WCW at the time. She was in both the cruiserweight and the hardcore divisions. For whatever reason, I don't know, just to be different. But then as well, she was also at a comedic role where she was a Nitro girl called Beef.
Right.
Yeah. really. So she was still going back to the well again of the stuff she didn't like, unfortunately. And unfortunately, she passed away in July 2001 at age 40 with a heart attack, which is a shame, really, because she, you know, she wasn't too bad in, you know, in the 80s. She was working with a lot of great workers, don't get me wrong, but she didn't stand out as someone that was super bad in that All Japan run. But in the 95 run, it was never destined to be anything but bar what it was. It had no legs on it. Once she'd jobbed around the horn to Alondra Blaze, what else could you do with it?
Look at that run in 1999 that she had. Three matches, right? A mud wrestling match with Miss Elizabeth on Nitro. A defeat against Norman Smiley for the hardcore title, so a man versus woman match, which is all the rage these days, I'm told, isn't it? The intergender stuff.
Yeah.
Pioneering back in 1999 there. And then she takes on Medusa on Thunder. It's so like random. Anyway, let's. What's the next question, Alan?
Okay, so we'll get back in the sack. And the next question is, dear Alan and Parv, discuss Owen Hart's short runs with Jim Neidhart as New Foundation and Coco Ware as High Energy. And that's from Lou Spadone on Twitter. So good question there from Lou. So Owen Hart, quite interesting little stints he had in two short-lived tag teams here, Parv. So the first one being the New Foundation. So what kind of memories do you have of the New Foundation?
Well, to be honest, I don't have a huge amount of memories of them. I remember High Energy quite a lot. But New Foundation feels like it really wasn't together for very long. And they didn't crop up on any pay-per-views, did they, as far as I'm aware. So it was very short-lived, wasn't it? It was just like a month, 2 months?
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically the run that they had was just a couple of months, and that was the end of that. And then he ended up just after that teaming with Jim Powers, did Owen Hart, you know, which was never destined to be a good tag team if you're associated with Jim Powers. But he had that couple of months where with Jim Neidhart, and I do remember it at the time, and it was never anything for me that was ever going to be destined to be good, because any team that are given the new moniker in front of the name and never destined to be good, you know, in history, had the kind of the New Rockers. In WWF, we had the New Midnight Express in WWF. Neither of those two teams. We had the New Dream Team, if you remember as well, Parv, of Dino Bravo and Greg Valentine, yeah. When Brutus Beefcake split. And again, they weren't great. So putting New in front, go on, sorry.
And the, I mean, they didn't put the new moniker, but we talked about, didn't we, the Crush version of Demolition. It never works, that deal of changing one of the partners.
No, it never really does. It does in music, but not in wrestling. Sometimes you can get away with changing someone in a band and you know, going on to greater things. But in wrestling, you change a member of a tag team, it's never really going to work out.
The only time, really, is Stan Lane for Dennis Condrey, Midnights. I mean, I guess that you can say that the second version of the Midnights worked, but really, most of the time, it doesn't work. What I will say, I mean, I watched a few of these matches earlier on, and Owen looks really good in them. Like, he is doing stuff in those matches that you typically don't see in the kind of scene of early, you know, late 91, early 92. You know, just in terms of his moves, his coming off the top rope, his suplexes and things. Like he feels like a breath of fresh air to me, Owen does.
Well, at the time, I mean, 1991 was such a varied year for Owen Hart. He'd gone from working, he was working in UWA in Mexico. He did a couple of dates for WCW where he was beating Rip Rogers. That was on Power Hour. That's a pretty good match from memory. Beating a few other guys, tagging with Brian Pillman, Calgary Connection there in Stampede. So he had a little run there in WCW, and you know, he never pursued that for whatever reason. Then he went and did some New Japan work. So he was in the top of the junior tournament, Super Junior tournament in 91. And then he went back to Mexico, and then he did a short stint in Europe. So he'd actually worked for All Star. And he'd work as well for Catch Wrestling, Otto Vance's promotion. And he also did a match for Joel Goodhart's Tri-State Wrestling against Izuka on TWA's Autumn Armageddon 2, which was kind of hot tape around the time period with Tape Traders, from memory. So, yeah, he had a really interesting run around this time. And then he went into the WWF, tagged him up with Jim Neidhart for, you know, a few matches. That didn't work out. Jim Neidhart normally doesn't work out, you know, for long around this period. It comes and goes in the WWF. So then after that, he was positioned and he was given the tag team High Energy with Coco Ware. And how were they dressed, Parv? What is your main memory of them
I just wanted to touch on one thing, Alan, is that when I was watching these matches earlier on, it became really clear to me that Lord Al is a massive Owen mark. Like, he clear, you know, like when you can tell, like when a commentator just genuinely just loves a wrestler.
Yeah.
I think every time you see Lord Al call a Lord an Owen Hart match, he absolutely just like marks for everything he does. So I just thought it was an interesting continuity thing that, because like, I don't know, remember like Jesse Ventura loved Savage, and even when Savage turned, he was still kind of like liked Savage, or like he loved Rick Rude, for example.
Yeah.
Owen was clearly a Lord Al guy. And so when he sides with Owen against Brett, like years later, it's just lovely continuity. So I thought I'd mention that. But it, in terms of the Coco Ware thing, the thing that really jumped out at me is that when they debuted, Coco Ware was wearing his old late 80s gear. Like he was still in the like the spangly. He had Frankie with him. He was in the spangly. You know, that kind of the old gear that he had. He wasn't.
Yeah, he was wearing like a glove like Michael Jackson and those goggles like Savage wore.
Yeah, those like shades. And it wasn't until they had a few matches together that he kind of changed to be in the more into the, I mean, they had some pretty awful gear, High Energy, didn't they? Like baggy kind of patchwork.
Parachute pants. It was all the rage though, wasn't it? Where not MC Hammer. Yeah, it was MC Hammer, wasn't it? Who had the big parachute pants around this time. So maybe it was a takeoff of that. But also just to touch on before I forget as well of the New Foundation, they were dressed like taxi drivers or like Sami Zayn is now, you know, with the checkers. But yeah, it wasn't done in like a ska punk kind of way. It was just done for no reason. They were just these checkers that they had and on these headbands and things. And they didn't look very brightly coloured though. I don't think it really looked that cool at all.
Very, I mean, thinking about High Energy here and thinking about the competition, I honestly think this is one of the few times that WCW really had the kind of, like, if you think about Too Cold Scorpio and how cool he was, and think about how lame this is, like, as a kid in 1992, like, I don't know, I just think it's one of the times where, like, Vince and co dropped the ball. Like, this is so uncool, isn't it? Like, even in 92, did you think this was cool when you were a kid?
No, this is what I mean. In 92, I was 10, so I was the perfect person to them to think this was cool or not. And no, it wasn't anything I thought. I thought it looked ridiculous. I like wrestlers to, you know, look like someone like Bret Hart, you know, wear that kind of outfit, Mr. Perfect, not kind of these baggy pants. So yeah, they look like they could, you know, blow away in a gust of wind.
I mean, Bret was cool, and here his little brother is just like being made to look like a, literally a clown. I mean, it's just like, but anyway, despite the awful gear, Owen looked good in all of these matches too. And I actually think that the team wasn't bad. Like Coco Ware is really underrated as a wrestler. I mean, this is quite late on in his career, but like that had the potential to be good if they treated them as a deal. But High Energy is one of those teams who were kind of capped as to where, what they could do. Like, so Money Inc. were the champs around this time, and they had a couple of shots against Money Inc. But like, you could never seriously consider High Energy holding the tag belts. Like, were they ever a contenders in your view when you were a kid?
No, not at all. They were losing to people like the Head Shrinkers all the time when the Head Shrinkers debuted, and they were beating people like, you know, Dean Wolf, Brooklyn Brawler, people like that. So they were never anything that was considered a threat. They were exciting though, don't get me wrong. And Owen Hart always stood out to me. Great worker. Really, really great worker. but it wasn't, you know, a team I could take seriously to go for a run for the titles.
They're positioned at that, like, Bolshevik level, basically. They always had, the tag division always had, like, two tiers, and they're clearly in tier two. So, and considering there's only ever, like, two or three teams to who could win the belt, you don't want to be in tier two if you're a tag team.
No, definitely not. I mean, they tagged for a good year or so as well. You know, from 92, you know, into April, May time in 93.
Well, one of the things that really interested me, Alan, and we had a long talk about this before we started recording today, is like, what was Coco Ware up to between, like, I don't know, 1989 and this point? Like, can you remember anything that he did? And that led us onto a little journey, didn't it? Do you want
to? Yeah, we had a good look at what he was up to. So he was being used as well in Memphis for the USWA, and he was one of the kind of earliest examples of this with the relationship with WWF. I don't know if it was on a per date deal with the WWF, and he was based and he lived in Memphis, and that's why he could be used there when the WWF weren't using him. But it's quite interesting that he was working dates for the USWA, and he actually won the USWA Unified World Heavyweight title from Jerry Lawler. And as the champion, he was jobbing with Owen Hart to the Beverly Brothers on a house show in Malloy, Illinois, you know, a week later. And then he dropped the title again, you know, back to Jerry Lawler for his 5 millionth, you know, run at the title in the USWA. But that was quite an interesting little nugget of information we dug up there, Parv.
I mean, if you were a fan in Memphis at that time, you'd be watching your champion kind of not be mentioned on WWF TV, like, literally losing to Blake Beverly. It's really weird to think about, but it's what happened. I thought it was quite interesting to look at, like, the average week of a Coco Ware around this time. So this is in September, okay, 2nd of September. He loses, tagging with Robert Fuller against Awesome Kong and Vic the Bruiser, okay? Then, literally, a few days later, and that was in Memphis, okay? Then he's in Lowell, Massachusetts, working in a losing effort to Big Bully Busick, who's a Letters from Kayfabe favourite.
And a Chadley favourite.
And a Chadley favourite, yeah. And then the next night, he loses to Busick again. And then and that's in Maine, USA. So that he would have literally had to fly from Maine, USA, back to Memphis to take on Awesome Kong and Vic the Bruiser tagging with Jimmy Valiant in 1991. A few days later, he's back in Allentown in Pennsylvania, taking on Brooklyn Brawler in a house show. And then literally a couple of days later, he's back in Memphis taking on Reggie B. So he's literally flying back and forth to Memphis several times a week to fill contractual obligations with both companies at the same time. And he keeps this going for years. Like, he does it all the way through 92. All the way through 93, and from what I can see, he's still doing it in 94.
Well, it's a sweet gig, that, I think. You know, he's obviously lives in the Memphis area, and, you know, working there when the dates aren't, you know, for him in the WWF. I think that's perfect. There's not many guys at that level who are able to kind of, you know, do both things. So hats off to Mr. Ware there. So with this, do you think High Energy were a better team than the New Foundation?
Without doubt. Coco's got a lot of energy and has always been kind of a fun guy, and Owen was explosive. So it kind of makes sense on paper. I just think maybe more could have been done with them, a few angles maybe, because really they were there to make up the numbers in the tag division, weren't they? Like,
yeah, it's pretty much.
It's just somebody to beat. I mean, the Beverleys were kind of the same, but at least the Beverleys got a few angles here and there.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to High Energy, well, not to be fair to them, but they were beating teams like Barry Horowitz and Skinner, people like that. And there's another team, and I've never heard of them, and I've never seen them come up on results. And they did a run around the house show circuit with a team called Double Trouble. And if you look at this part, this was 92 September time. So from the 24th of September 92 up till the 4th of October 92, they worked a loop with Double Trouble. It were just called Double Trouble 1 and Double Trouble 2.
Who the hell are these guys?
One of them was Big Val Puccio, who I think was an ECW guy. And that was like 95 time he worked ECW. But the other one, I don't think I know who that is. Never come across him anyway myself, the first guy. So that was Double Trouble 2, was Big Val Puccio.
Tony Puccio.
So yeah, they're obviously brothers. And he worked for the WWF before as well, kind of jobbing to other people. I mean, Double Trouble as well, they were jobbing on house shows, two-on-one handicap matches to Animal, when Animal came back in September 92, October 92 time. So that's quite interesting who they were, just uncovered on air as well.
I mean, they probably never had a TV appearance, I'd imagine.
No, I never came across them on TV. They were just used, on house shows. So have we got anything else you want to add about kind of this question, Parv, or do you think we're done and we've answered it?
What was actually the original question again? To just discuss it. Okay, well, we have discussed it. I would have actually liked to have seen maybe them go on a run or have an extended feud. Like, they did have a match with Money Inc., and it wasn't bad. Like, it's a short match, but it's not like, you know, DiBiase's a good worker, Owen's a good worker. I would have actually, instead of pairing Money Inc. with the Natural Disasters, I mean, like, what can you do with Tugboat? You know, what can you do with, like, nothing? I would have rather have seen Irwin and Ted go on an extended run with Coco and Owen. I just think from a match quality standpoint, they could have set that division on fire. Like, Owen and Ted could have a great match. And they did have a really... Ted has a decent match with Owen in 1988 when he's the Blue Blazer. It's only like 5 minutes on MSG or whatever, but it's good because like he can take the offense, Owen can, and Owen, like both of those guys in Money Inc. could take all of Owen's suplex variations and so on. So yeah. you understand what I'm saying. Like, so if I was booking for match quality, that seems like something decent, you know, and stick like, I don't know, Natural Disasters against the Nasty Boys or Hedge Shrinkers or whatever, you know. So
yeah,
that's what I would do. Any thoughts?
No, I think that would work better, you know, in hindsight. At the time, though, Earthquake was still, you know, a name. Typhoon, big guy, looked impressive, couldn't really work that well. But I think it was not really pushing smaller teams in this era, you know. So maybe a little bit later on, we saw that coming on, but I think even with the bigger teams, they were still like the Nasties. They weren't body guys, but they were still bigger. We had Natural Disasters, again, not body guys, obviously, still bigger. Hedge Shrinkers, same thing again. So even though we were moving away from the steroid kind of looking era, Vince still didn't really want to go with the smaller kind of guys at this time period.
One thing I will say real quick before we move off these guys is that if people haven't seen Coco Ware, kind of like... Like, if people just think, oh, well, he was just a jobber in WWF, he does have some really good matches in Memphis, especially in the early 80s when he's tagging with Bobby Eaton. He goes by the name of Sweet Brown Sugar down there. That's a really kick-ass team. Like, Coco, like, could throw a really mean suplex.
Not just a suplex. He massacred jobbers as well in Memphis.
And he absolutely destroyed jobbers as well. So... like watching Coco Ware and Bobby Eaton just rip shit up in 1983, well worth an hour of your time. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. Let's move on.
Okay, we'll get another one from the sack. So, dear Alan and Parv, what were your favourite non-pay-per-view championship matches from the expansion era? And that's from King Papa 1015 on Twitter. So let's kind of get the time frame we're talking about here, Parv. So the expansion era, what we kind of saying this is?
So I think 84 till about 87, broadly speaking, the time of the rock and roll era. And as we've discussed before, from about 88 on, it starts locking into more kind of cartoon era, I guess.
Yeah, so, I mean, this time period, so 84 to 87, I've picked some matches here. I mean, you can give your thoughts on them, Parv. And I think that's the best way to go through this. And all these matches will be on this week's playlist. So, Chris Hero, if you're listening, there'll be a playlist this week. Sorry, I dropped the ball last week. I promised I was going to do it, and I never did. Ended up going to Berlin instead. I think that was a more worthwhile endeavour. But yeah, I've got it this week for you, Chris. So all these matches I'm going to mention now, they're all linked in the playlist, so people should check them out. Because they're all good matches, and they're all with Hulk Hogan. Because the question was kind of phrased that, you know, not in the expansion era. So the only pay-per-view championship matches would be with Hogan, because he had the title from 84 up until 88, didn't he? So... it's all Hogan matches. So the first one that I picked that I enjoyed at the time was Hulk Hogan versus David Schultz. That was the 17th of June 1984. I've not watched this particular match in a while, Parv. Have you got any memories of it?
I seem to remember that this match is pretty wild. Like Schultz is, you know...
Schultz is Schultz.
Schultz is like Southern, he's dirty, you know... my memory, and in fact, this is going to be a comment for a lot of these matches, is that Hogan during this kind of early 84, 85 sort of time, he's a bit more like rough and ready. Like there's more, like these matches are pretty gritty. Like you'll see, does he bleed in this one? The one against Schultz? Can you remember?
Yeah, I think from memory, this is one where he does bleed. I mean, he does bleed in quite a few matches around this period, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, it's not more like he really takes a beating and like the beatdowns are like, he lets them run like longer before the comeback comes. And often it will be with blood. And you have that, you know, we talked about before how the presentation wasn't quite set. This is still kind of like some of the smoky halls and things that they're like, you know, it's MSG, it's Philly, but it's like old school presentation. So I think there's a bit more kind of grit about the whole thing.
Do you think some of Hogan's matches are better when there's long periods of the match where he's selling? Do you think he's a good seller and someone that can get, you know, garner sympathy?
I think Hogan is really underrated in that aspect. I mean, I've been saying it for years, that Hogan understands the importance of a heat sequence. And often, his only offense in the match would be like, maybe he'd do a slam right at the start of the match to pop the crowd. The big boot and the leg drop and a couple of punches in the comeback. But 90% of the match is Hogan taking an ass kick in. And dying. I mean, that's the thing he did really well. And I think that's something that Hogan lost later on. Is like, one of the reasons why that WCW run is so bloody awful is because he starts working like he's Superman and doesn't do the heat, like doesn't give the heels anything. You know, because he knows he's winning, so he can afford to make the heels look as good as possible. And it makes the crowd more invested, like, you know, maybe they know that he's going to win at the end of it, ultimately, but it's still good to tell that comeback story. So, I mean, it's some really good matches during this 84 stretch. I can see Bob Orton's got a match there. That's definitely worth watching. Greg Valentine's got a couple of matches against him, you know. So, yeah, I just would recommend that seeking out 84 Hogan in general. And you'll see what I mean. It's just a bit more rough than
less polished than we'd see Hogan in a kind of more of a formulaic match structure that we would see later on. And I'm going to shatter a few illusions for people here. Hogan's always been touted this mediocre worker, and I'm going to say something now that Hulk Hogan in all these matches are posted on this YouTube playlist. All these matches are above 3.5 stars. Hogan could work with the right opponent. You could get a 4 or even a 4.25 star match out of him. Case in point, there was a match that was in 91. It was the 12th of December 91 on a combined SWSWF show where he worked Junichiro Tenryu, and that match is absolutely fantastic. That's a 4.25 star match, and Hogan's holding his own in this match. And we've got these kind of guys nowadays that are touted as these great workers. Case in point, Cody Rhodes. Let's look at someone like Cody Rhodes. He can work with a variety of people. You are not going to see a better Cody Rhodes match at this time period where we are now when we're kind of recording this in a 3-star match. Cody Rhodes is Mr. 3 stars. He's boring. He's not for me. I don't like him. And then we're looking at Hogan that's been maligned, that's been slated for years. He's not a great worker. I'm providing 6 examples here of matches where Hogan is actually holding his own. And this is all a different variety of opponents we've got in this. I've listed this Hogan David Schultz, like we discussed. We've got Hogan Don Morocco match from MSG in 85, Hogan Bob Orton in 87, Hogan Savage in 86, Hogan Morocco again in 85, and then Hogan Savage in 86 again. So there's 3 or 4 different opponents he's got there, and all the matches are good, and they're worth seeking out. So rant over. Hogan isn't that bad of a worker as people kind of remember or think of him.
No, I mean, one of the things that Hogan's got above a lot of other guys is psychology, crowd control, knowing how long, like timing, knowing how long to give the heel and when to time that comeback. And that's something that a lot of workers could learn from. I mean, there's a reason why Hogan was Hogan, you know. I just chuck a couple of matches in there, Alan, that you didn't mention. There's a really good match against Terry Funk in late 85. I mean, Terry Funk is just wild during that brief run that he has. Definitely worth watching. And I know it's late on in the time period, but the match where Harley Race lands on the table and ends up getting injured, that's a really good match, the Harley Race Hogan match. Have you seen that one, Alan?
Yeah, I've seen that one where he slides down the table. Takes that kind of crazy bump for someone his age.
I think it's on Saturday night's main event. But, I mean, that's probably a contender for, like, the best Saturday night's main event match, for example. And if I was making a Hogan highlight reel, I'd stick that Harley match in there as well.
Yeah, I'll add those two to the playlist as well. The Hogan Terry Funk one. Are we talking the Saturday night's main event one, or there was a really good one from Philadelphia as well months before?
I think I'm primarily thinking of the Saturday night's main event, but the Philly match is well worth watching too. Like all of that entirety of that Terry Funk run is pretty good, to be honest. So even when he's like facing Junkyard Dog and stuff, so.
Well, yeah, we get good value from Terry Funk, and it's we're recording this on a Tuesday, so it's every Tuesday on Twitter, it's Terry Tuesday. So if people want to seek out some cool photos of Terry Funk, just put the hashtag Terry Tuesday in, and you'll see a load of different people posting GIFs and photos from the great man himself.
Yeah, I do just want to say really quickly as well, one guy who never really gets talked up enough from this time period, from this 84-85 time frame, is Bob Orton Jr. I mean, Bob Orton Jr., I've said it before, was like a kind of, how can I put it, like a kind of, you know how like AJ Styles just like makes up moves and he's really flashy in his offense and stuff now?
Yeah.
Bob Orton Jr. was like the kind of, that of that generation. Like he does spots that you just don't see other guys do in those, around this time. So anytime you can find like Bob Orton Jr. in like a 12-minute match at MSG against Hogan, I would recommend seeking out those sorts of deals, because he's super underrated. I know the feud was mostly with Piper, but Orton was the worker there. So
yeah, because Orton would take the pinfalls, wouldn't he, where Piper, you know, like we've looked on in past episode, where Piper wouldn't be doing, you know, that kind of clean job.
Yeah, there's a phenomenal match from this time. I know it's not a championship match, but Orton versus Steamboat, like that's easily a 4-star match in my view. So yeah, I mean, I actually think that this time period that we're talking about is the time frame where Hogan had like the most amount of like great workers to play off of. Like these guys, like it's kind of before it was just Hogan versus Monster all the time, you know.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because he was still doing, you know, there's still Kamala knocking around in, you know, 84 time. But yeah, for the whole, it's kind of guys that could go and could work. And Hogan kind of played off them well. And I think, like I've mentioned, you know, a couple of times in this section, he held his own. So people can check that out and see, you know, make their own minds up there. So
some of those Iron Sheik return matches aren't bad. Like everybody's seen the one where he wins the belt, which is only like 5 minutes or whatever. But like Iron Sheik could go back in the day as well. Like, obviously, he kind of put on weight and when he was tagging with Nikolai and so on. But I'd recommend even like, there's one from Philly, for example, 2684. Definitely worth a watch, you know? So.
Oh, it just reminded me of something, not to do with Hulk Hogan, but on the episode there with Chris Hero, when he reminded me of the story with Bob Backlund and his belt that was made out of cardboard.
All right, so let's go over now to JT Rosero for the event center.
Let's take you down to the event center.
Thank you, Parv. Thank you, Alan. Appreciate it. And hope everyone's enjoying this week's episode of Letters from Kayfabe. JT Rosero here inside the event center. I want to take you back this week to 1995. December 17th, to be exact, and that was the date of In Your House number 5, retroactively known as In Your House Season's Beatings. And of course, kind of in the doldrums in many ways for the company. 1995, a very, very dark year for many fans of wrestling, and WWF fans in particular. This show did, though, have a little bit of a ray of hope coming off a pretty fun Survivor Series. We head down to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and we saw Razor Ramon and Marty Jannetty knock off the 1-2-3 Kid and Psycho Sid. Ahmed Johnson defeated Buddy Landell in a singles match, and that whole fiasco featuring the return of Jeff Jarrett and Dean Douglas on his way out the door. Hunter Hearst Helmsley knocked off Henry O. Godwin in a special hog pen match where Hillbilly Jim debuted as a referee and would later stay around as manager of Henry and eventually Phineas Godwin. Owen Hart defeated Diesel by disqualification when a very angry Diesel snapped and attacked the referee and just beat the crap out of Owen because he was still pissed about losing his title back at Survivor Series and mad at Owen for injuring his buddy Shawn Michaels. The Undertaker finally buried King Mabel, bringing an end to their feud, defeating him in a casket match and setting his sights forward on the World Heavyweight title that was now held by Bret Hart, who retained over the British Bulldog in the main event. A fantastic match, a rematch from SummerSlam 1992. And really, I don't want to say hidden, because I don't think it's hidden anymore. Forgotten, maybe, but a true classic. A bloody, bloody classic, amplified by the light blue mats around the Hershey Park Arena. And of course, they would later apologize, saying this was accidental blood, but if you take one look at what's going on, you know what's up. But it was for a good reason, because the match was fantastic, very stiff. The two guys beat the crap out of each other. And many fans believe it's even better than their SummerSlam 1992 match, and it just may be one of them. It's a great match. If you haven't seen it, go back and watch it. And of course, 1995, a dark year, but it led to many, many great things in the years to come. But it all kind of starts here, where they had to open the windows, get out all the must, kick out some of the dead wood and rebuild the roster that we see throughout the great year of 1996 and into the rebirth and throughout the dawn of the Attitude Era, 97, 98, 99. So, hope you guys enjoy the rest of this episode. Parv and Alan will be back in a moment to talk about the pre-pay-per-view era events in the WWF. Until next week, I'm JT Rizzero. Talk to you soon.
All right, well, thanks for that, JT. And I think it's time for our long topic this week, Alan.
Yes, let's get the long talk pick out the way here. So, dear Alan and Parv, I remember the WWF used to run a lot of pre-pay-per-view shows, such as SummerSlam Spectacular, Survivor Series Showdown, etc. What happened on these shows? Can you give us a history of these pre-pay-per-view shows? And that's from Johnny Schumacher from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. So, they had a few of these, didn't they, Parv, looking through, going back now, and they ran from 1990 to about 1993, and they didn't do them for every pay-per-view. They seemed to do them for SummerSlam. Survivor Series were the, you know, the two that they, you know, focused on. I don't remember. I remember there was like a March to WrestleMania show in like 93, and there was some other stuff, but they didn't do it, you know, like these ones.
No, I think WrestleMania 9 has got like a pre, like the March WrestleMania thing.
That's the one I'm referencing, yeah.
But, it's mainly Survivor Series Showdown and SummerSlam Spectacular. Those are the two we're really thinking about here. And they ran them in 91, 92, 93 for SummerSlam. And I think Survivor Series Showdown is what, 89 to
91.
I think it goes all the way to 93, I want to say.
Yes, 94. Sorry, Survivor Series goes to. And I think it's quite interesting because with the Survivor Series kind of pre-show or kind of warm-up or something to get, you know, pay-per-view buys, you know, a few days later when, you know, the pay-per-view aired, it was easy to do with Survivor Series because you just put a load of the guys that are in the multi-man matches, in singles matches against each other and have a little bit of a conflict there or something to kind of get interest in a match with, you know, more guys. So I think they were quite easy to book, Parv, and we can see that in like 89. We had the guys that were in, you know, opposing teams, you know, in singles matches against each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that they used these shows to do quite a lot was to like last minute book, like as someone who's played that game, Total Extreme Wrestling. You know that booking game?
Oh, I love that. No, I don't play it, but I remember you went on a little bit of an odyssey. It may have been late last year or early this year, where you kind of, you had a, what was it you were booking? The WWF, wasn't it? Yeah. WWF, yeah. In was it late 70s or an early 80s era?
1983. And then I had a kind of less successful follow-up where I tried to book the AWA in 1991.
You were trying to book the AWA in 91?
Yeah.
My God, that's like, you know, that's like starting up on Football Manager with someone in the, you know, the football conference and expecting to win the European title like 10 years later.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. So, time commitments and other things made... It's kind of like I've just haven't done anything on that for a while. But anyway, playing that game, when you're kind of booking towards a pay-per-view, you find that there's all these like loose ends and things that need to happen before the big event. And to me, like thinking like a booker, a lot of these shows feel like kind of Vince and co giving themselves a little bit of slack, like last minute stuff that needs to happen for like to set up pay-per-view stuff. You know what I'm talking about? So
no, I agree that I can see that. And I mean, we can go through all the shows here, and I don't know if that's of interest to some people, or we can just pick out the matches. What would you think is the best kind of way of doing this, Bob?
Let's go through them all. We'll go through the Survivor Series, because the Survivor Series one starts in 89, right? So it had Vince and Jesse on commentary. And then I'll just go through the results, and then you can take the next one, and we'll do it like that, okay?
Okay.
So Tito Santana, who was with Dusty Rhodes, pinned the Big Boss Man, who was with Slick and Akeem. And so that's obviously playing into the business that was happening at that time. Because they were all involved in a Survivor Series match, basically, weren't they, later on?
Yeah.
Mr. Perfect with the Genius pinned Bushwhacker Butch, who was with Bushwhacker Luke, with a Perfect Plex. Savage with Sensational Sherry pinned Hercules. The Ultimate Warrior defeated Tully Blanchard, who was with Bobby Heenan, at the 6 minute mark when Arn Anderson interfered. Now that's really interesting, because of course Tully didn't make it to the show, did he?
No, he didn't, the 89 one. So that this may have been his last appearance on TV. It would have been, wouldn't it?
It's his last match in the WWF, yeah.
Where he gets jobs out to Intercontinental Champion Warrior, and you know, it's a shame, really. Tully Blanchard is a great worker. We've seen that in Southwest. You know, we've seen that in the NWA, Jim Crockett. But, you know, you put him in with the Warrior, aesthetically, you can't see someone like Tully Blanchard beating the Ultimate Warrior. You know,
I can only imagine that match was just total pinball. You know.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
After the bout, Jim Neidhart, Shawn Michaels, Marty Jannetty made the save against Blanchard, Anderson, Haku, and Andre. Ultimate Heenan family there, as we discussed before. And then in the final match, Ted DiBiase with Virgil. There's his mention for today, Alan. he pinned Demolition Smash, after Zeus interfered on the floor and threw Smash back into the ring. After the bout, DiBiase put Smash in the $1 million dream before Axe made the save, challenging Zeus to a fight. Zeus was held back by DiBiase and Virgil. So just a little bit of business to get Zeus, you know, over with the crowd and, you know, establish him as more of a monster.
Well, no, he'd already kind of hurt, you know, he'd been knocking around, hadn't he?
It's just, this point. Just a little bit of business to put him in the fans' eyes. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of, just a reheat. What do they call it? A reheat for Zeus, you know. Right, why don't we go on to 1990, Alan?
Well, 1990, I mean, the matches themselves. We had Sergeant Slaughter beating Tito Santana. So this was Slaughter's kind of push he was getting at the time, getting ready to from beating the Ultimate Warrior at the Royal Rumble. So there's no kind of remarks I've got for this match. Is there anything there that you've got there, Parv?
No, I mean, it's just, you know, the simple, he needs a win at this point, and Tito's a established guy to go over, and Adnan involved in the finish there. Standard
practice.
Yeah.
Around that time with Slaughter. So second match was Rick Martel beating Marty Jannetty, and this was a fun match. Rick Martel was always good. Rick Martel. Someone asked the question today, can you point out some good Rick Martel matches? So I kind of posted some online there. So Rick Martel in this run is a kind of heel, wearing the kind of sweaters over himself. He kind of came back in the year previous as kind of this tanned heel. What did you think of him as a worker around this time, Parv?
Well, I mean, the thing is with Rick Martel, like a standard talking point in the sort of circles I'd walk in is that Rick Martel's like a phenomenal babyface, okay? Like one of the greatest ever, which may sound weird to some fans, but seriously, if you watch him elsewhere, he is tremendous as a babyface. So one part of you thinks, well, this is a waste of him. But another part of me thinks he was brilliant at being the model, and it was a really fun gimmick, and he completely embraced it, and he could still go I actually thought he's perfectly fine as the model. It's just like, he's just like a fun heel, but he's like a brilliant babyface. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think what doesn't help him as well is his accent. So he would work in a tag team. You know, he did that deal with Zenk where there was a Can-Am connection. But then, you know, as a singles babyface, could you really see Vince and Kevin Dunn and, you know, people like that going for someone who had this accent, being that they're so against that sort of thing. So he was never destined to be a kind of top face. So I think he fit better as a heel, as a kind of this arrogant, kind of cocky French Canadian guy. So it fits him better, you know, with what WWF were kind of looking for around that time.
The one thing I'd say about Rick the Model Martel, because he is like the arrogance, like he had it down, didn't he? Like the tennis racket. I mean, you even look back now and you just think the guy's having the time of his life, and it's awesome. Like,
it was a believable character as well,
and it was believable, and like, I just think it's a great gimmick.
And I liked his music as well. He's from Cocoa Beach, Florida.
I just always wonder why that was pushed as such a mid-card deal. Like, I would have preferred him to, like, be up in the mix, you know? Like, more like Mr. Perfect level than Dino Bravo level.
Do you think he'd have been better if he was kind of wearing custom suits, doing the whole kind of Ric Flair shtick? Do you think that would have helped him a bit more?
Taking it up a notch. I think that the character was perfectly fine, but, like, he could have been pushed at a higher level than he was. Like, it's like there seemed to be a cap on where they were prepared to go with it. And maybe like the whole deal with Tito not blowing off on pay-per-view also, I guess, hurt it, because that was like the signature kind of feud for him at this point. So all of those things, I think, may have helped. I mean, why couldn't he have had an IC title run?
Yeah, well, I think he could have fit around that time, you know, getting a run with that belt. But no, it was never meant to be. But before we get too off topic, then we've got the next match was Earthquake versus Boss Man. Then we had Honky Tonk Man Bret Hart and Smash and Kerry Von Erich finishing that off. So, anything else to add for the Survivor Series 90, Parv?
Feels quite late for Honky, that, to me.
Yeah. When we would have probably finished around this time, actually. I think, did he go into 91? I can't remember now.
Yeah, well, I mean, they break up, don't they, as we've talked about, rhythm and blues. But I mean, I guess in Honky, probably like annoyed someone and ended up getting fired. That's what usually happens with him. So anyway, let's carry on going.
So the next one was a 91. So do you want to just quickly run through that one?
I'll do this. So we get the rare teaming of Vince and Bobby Heenan on commentary for this one. Boss Man defeated Earthquake. Is that a rematch? That's a rematch from the year earlier.
Yes.
Around the 10-minute mark, Jake Roberts interfered, as well as Typhoon. After the bout, the Legion of Doom made the save for Boss Man against Typhoon, Jake Roberts, and IRS. And, of course, as we've discussed before, Jake never made it to the Survivor Series, did he?
No. There was a lot going on around this time, wasn't there?
Yeah. But Bushwhacker Luke pinned Blake Beverly with a roll-up. Rare win for a Bushwhacker there. Teddy Biasi with Sensational Sherry pinned the million-dollar champion, Virgil, at the 9:46 mark after Repo Man interfered and hit Virgil with a title belt. After the bout, Tito Santana made the save when Virgil was about to put $100 bill in Virgil's, when DiBiase was about to put $100 bill in Virgil's mouth, and we discussed this in some depth when we did the Virgil Tito connection. Do you remember all the way?
The
back?
Friends, yeah, they were friends to the end,
and they lived off this for the next 2 years. So. Tito Santana himself pinned Skinner with a flying forearm, and Roddy Piper was around, and he pinned Hercules with a bulldog. So. Yep. And then 92.
So, yeah, 92. I mean, I've got here, we've got Tatanka pinged Repo Man. So, Tatanka 92, I'd been around about a year by this point anyway. So, we had that. And then we had Marty Jannetty beating the Brooklyn Brawler. Kamala pinned, I've got listed here as just Red. What have you got for that one, Parv?
Red Tyler.
Red Tyler. That's quite interesting. That's the first jobber would you say that's been on one of these that we've seen so far?
Yeah, out and out jobber there, making the card. So I guess...
Well, it's getting Kamala warmed up for Undertaker. I think he had a casket match at Survivor Series in 92.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, the 92 Survivor Series was the first book like a traditional pay-per-view with more singles matches and things like that. So that they dropped the team format in 92, didn't they? Which may...
Yeah, I mean, you had the main event, though. It was tag team, but it wasn't, you know, 4-on-4 or 5-on-5 as it was in 87. So after that, we had Earthquake beat IRS, who was Jimmy Hart with Jimmy Hart. So there was no Ted DiBiase there. Where do you think old Ted was?
So what happened was, Earthquake... So this was via DQ when... WWF Tag Team Champion Ted DiBiase tripped Earthquake.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As he attempted a sit-down. Prior to the bout, footage was shown of Money, Inc. defeating the Natural Disasters and winning the tag titles, as well as a pre- and post-match altercation Money, Inc. had with the Nasty Boys. Midway through the bout, Typhoon and DiBiase made their way to ringside to cheer on their respective partners. After the match, DiBiase injured Earthquake's eye before Typhoon got in the ring, scaring Money, Inc. to the floor. Moments later, Gene Okerlund interviewed Money, Inc., Jimmy Hart, the Beverly Brothers, and the Genius backstage regarding their match at Survivor Series against the Natural Disasters and the Nasty Boys.
Oh, yeah, there was that match, wasn't there? There was the tag team.
And that was the rules where if your partner was pinned, you had to leave.
Rubbish. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it wasn't as traditional as previous years. Yeah, no, not great at all. So fifth match on this show was the Big Boss Man beat Barry Horowitz, which was, you know, going to happen. Barry Horowitz never, you know, did anything on TV. We may discuss him in the future. He had that little short run in 95 as a face, didn't he, in 96? Yeah. He was giving some wins on TV, patting his own back. And then we had the Headshrinkers, and Headshrinkers beating a team of Red Fox and Royce Royal. Interesting that the Headshrinkers, when they were brought in, they just killed jobbers. They did this a lot as well in the NWA in the 89 period, where they were just kind of really the best squash matches were Headshrinker squash matches. And even in 92, 93, Headshrinker squash matches were brutal. I posted a GIF the other day of them doing the flapjack on PJ Walker, just incredible. Yeah. But they spiked him. It was, you know, they did this quite a few times. And, you know, if I was a jobber, you know, coming into TV and I'd see my name, you know, on the chalkboard matched against the Headshrinkers, I wouldn't be a happy chappy.
Samu could really go. I actually think Samu is pretty an underrated worker around this. Like, do you know what I mean? Like within the two of them,
yeah,
he was the slightly more polished performer. In the Smoke and SWAT team and in the Headshrinkers, it might.
Well, my favorite kind of early, not early, but was, I think it was 94 when they tried to put Fatu. He was tag team with the Barbarian at this point. Samu had left, and they tried to make him wear boots. Do you remember this? And he couldn't get used to wearing boots, and it was kind of this little gimmick that was going on around the time, and that was always a little bit of an odd one to me remembering that one.
Right.
So we went on to 93, didn't we, Parv?
None of these... I'll just want to say none of these cards seem like they've been much cop so far. So the 93, Doink pinned Bastion Booger with a schoolboy roll-up. After the bout, Doink poured Tabasco sauce on Booger's pizza when he wasn't looking. Moments later, Booger ate the pizza and sold the hot sauce as though it was burning his mouth.
classic Bastion Booger, who we spoke about in the, was it last episode we had Bastion Booger? Maybe it was the one before.
A couple of episodes ago,
yeah, it was now with Booger. But yeah, I think it was just set up that wacky, stupid kind of comedy match at Survivor Series where we had, was it Booger, the Headshrinkers, and Bam Bam?
Yeah, and like all the doinks, all the, like the many doinks running around, isn't it?
No, we were only allowed one doink, but they were allowed dink pinks.
Oh, yeah.
Was that not 94? I have no idea. Oh, no, it wasn't. The Bushwhackers and Men on a Mission, weren't they dressed as doinks?
That's right, yeah.
Something and, like that,
and
anyway.
The one the following year was the one with the many dinks and...
Yeah, I mean, I do apologise, Parv. I do get my kayfabe memories mixed up from time to time.
Next match, IRS pinned Marty Jannetty with the write-off lariat, or the write-off check, as it was known. Did you know IRS's finisher was known as the write-off?
I only knew that. They never pushed that on TV particularly hard. It was mainly on the computer game, yeah, where we had that god-awful music as well, the typewriter.
Yeah. I always thought that looked really awesome, that write-off. Like, it's a, if anybody ever goes and watches SummerSlam 93, he really takes, like, 1-2-3 Kid's head off with that. So he nailed that.
Would you say it's similar to kind of the five arm, the kind of write-off? Was the write-off just more like a diving clothesline?
It is a diving clothesline, basically, yeah. A diving clothesline. But he kind of got the whole, like, he really nailed it. One of the things that IRS did well, Crush with Mr. Fuji defeated Virgil with a submission with a head vice. After the bout, Crush reapplied the hold. So Evil, do you remember Evil Foreigner Crush?
Yeah, who took some kind of inspiration from Kamala, who had moons on him or things of that nature on his tights, on his face. This was Evil Crush, wasn't it? This was Japanese sympathizer Crush.
Virgil seems to me like the perfect guy to take the head vice.
He's just got that round head. He's just got a great round visual.
Yeah. The right head to crush like a grape. And then the world champion, Yokozuna, defeated Bret Hart via DQ at around the 17-minute mark when Owen Hart, who appeared during the final moment, attacked Yoko, hit him with his own salt bucket. Owen's interference followed Fuji hitting Bret in the face with the salt bucket behind the referee's back as Bret had the sharpshooter applied. And that also appeared on the Dungeon Collection DVD that was put out for Bret. 17 minutes, Yokozuna. Have you ever seen that match? I haven't seen that.
No, I've not seen that match either. And I'm going to have to track that down because it's quite interesting. Obviously, they're sowing the seeds of Owen Hart and Bret by Owen coming out and kind of costing Bret the match, but not on purpose. But yeah, and Yokozuna obviously was pushed there. He was going as kind of the main heel still against Luger in the Allied Powers type team versus the Foreign Menaces.
I'm just wondering how sweaty he is by the end of that 17 minutes.
There'll be a lot of rest holds.
Yeah, I imagine we'll get some...
A lot of nerve holds,
pinches and things, yeah. All right, why don't we have a little look at this SummerSlam spectacular?
Oh, no, just before we do, quickly, the new 94 one. I don't know the results in front of me, but I've just got, it was Heavenly Body Smoking Guns. Who won that one? Can you see?
No, mine seems to run out in 93, so...
Oh, no, and then we had Davey Boy Smith versus Owen Hart. So there was a 94 one, apparently. I've got some information here, but if you've not got that, take that one with a pinch of salt, guys. Not too sure about that, but we'll briefly kind of touch on the SummerSlam ones because we went through the Survivor Series ones. And maybe we kind of... I'm just going to talk about... You can go through the cards if you wish, but I'm going to just talk about my favourite match from them. Okay. The ones that stands out for me anyway. And it's a really good match. And I remember watching the SummerSlam Spectacular 93, and it did air over here in the UK pre-SummerSlam. And it was the steel cage match between the Steiner Brothers and Money Inc. And this was kind of Ted's last hurrah, wasn't it, around this time? Because he worked at SummerSlam 93. Then he went over to All Japan, had the back injury, and then he reappeared again at Royal Rumble 94 as a commentator. So, but this match was absolutely fantastic. I remember as how old I would have been then, 11, really on the edge of my seat. You know, they played the steel cage gimmick well, where they both had to touch the floor and one had to keep coming in to rescue the other. And yeah, it was a really, really fun match. And I would probably have that match around 3.5, 3.75 stars. And that was the best match from all these kind of shows that we're discussing that I can think of anyway.
Easily the standout match of all of them, Alan, and arguably like the last great DiBiase match. How can I put? I've tried to explain this before, but like in the world of the WWF at this time, for a match to stand out on all of these Coliseum Home videotapes, it was something. You know, it wasn't like the world wasn't. You know, you could just watch 5-star matches at the, you know,
drop of a hat. I
literally type it into YouTube and there's 15 5-star matches. It wasn't like that. So when you did get a match like this, it really stands out to you, which is why I've always pimped Steiner Brothers versus Money Inc. They have a few good, they actually have a few decent TV matches a couple of weeks before this as well.
Yeah, I know they had that one a couple of weeks before as well that I came across today. But yeah, I think they work well together, those two teams. And I don't think the Steiners, I think they had a bit more respect for Money Inc. and they wouldn't be, you know, as reckless as they would have been with other teams around this time. So I don't think that, you know, anything to do with Ted's neck injury was anything to be working with Scott before obviously going to All Japan and getting a neck injury properly. So I'm not going to put any blame on the Steiners there. So yeah, we had, we'll go through it then quickly. 91, we had Road Warrior Hawk versus Nobbs.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go through these, I think, because you've got the actual results in front of you, Pat.
So I got Brett versus Barbarian, and see you win this. Clearly Brett went over there in 14 minutes. That's got the potential to be pretty good, actually. That seems like it would be a good match to me. Irwin Arshreister versus Mark Thomas.
This is early IRS this time period, because he came in, didn't he, around this time?
Very early. So it's like when IRS has got the longer hair and the black briefcase.
And the brown pants. Do you remember the brown pants, Parv?
Brown, he would have had them in this match, actually, wouldn't he? The brown pants.
He may have worn the brown pants in this match. They're horrible. They didn't match. I mean, I don't get that. Why you'd wear brown pants with a white shirt and a red tie? But yeah, there we go. And then we had, after the IRS, we had the Macho Man Bachelor Party, didn't we, Parv? We all know that was kind of the event, wasn't it, with all sorts of hijinks.
Jameson, Slick, Mean Gene, Roddy Piper, Coco Ware, Bobby Heenan, all in attendance. So,
do you invite Jameson to your bachelor party?
Gorilla Monsoon, Sean Mooney turned up, the Bushwhackers. So that they all got their belly dancers.
Where's Hogan? Where's the Ultimate Warrior? You know what I mean? You had all these kind of, where's Bret Hart? You had all these kind of geeks turning up for Randy Savage's bachelor party. I would have thought a better kind of standard of guest would have come.
The Bushwhackers bring out a giant cake. Bobby Heenan wants to get first dibs, and then a really fat chick in a bunny suit comes out of the cake, and she sexually harasses Heenan. So there we go.
One for the ages there, guys. Then we had this is a match that we touched upon, Parv, on a previous episode, which was Ricky Steamboat, Kerry Von Erich, and David Boy Smith. Awesome kind of three guys there against a three-man Orient Express team of Tanaka, Sato, and Kato. Like we said, we touched on that in a previous episode, didn't we, Parv?
Yep. And then you have Hogan versus Slaughter, actually a decent match. So, in fact, this is easily the best card that we've looked at, this SummerSlam Spectacular 91. Looks like a really good card from top to bottom. And then Natural Disaster Squash to finish things out. So,
no, you know what I've also got listed here? We've got Virgil versus some jobber that Ted DiBiase sent in to take care of Virgil.
Who's this?
I don't know. That's what he just says. That's what I've got. Don't really matter. I just thought it was quite funny wording. And then we've got the Mountie. He went on a tour of a jail. So, you know, he's trying to...
I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, entice the boss man to say you're going to be spending a night in the slammer boss man, which didn't end up being the case, did it, Parv? And it ended up being kind of a comedy moment at the SummerSlam 91 card itself.
I remember that being a pretty big deal at the time, actually, that whole Mountie boss man... Mountie spends a night in... Oh, here we are. Ted DiBiase's mystery man. I've got it now.
Who was it?
Who was it? Let's have a look. Mystery... it's not The Undertaker, I'll tell you that. It's Barry Darso. Between gimmicks, under a hood.
Brilliant.
So he's not quite a Repo Man yet, and he's in between Smash and Repo Man.
Because, you know, he was actually, I don't know if you remember this, he actually wore kind of a full mask as well during the Repo Man run. Do you remember this, Parv? Or do you just remember him with the Hamburglar type?
I only remember him with a Hamburglar. I don't remember full mask.
He kind of had this full mask kind of thing. Had tyres on it as well, tyre marks, like he'd been run over, like the rest of his suit had. But yeah, he had this full mask thing going on a few times. So that was the 91 card. So 92, so this was the lead up. And there was another match that stood out. This is in the video playlist as well, and I mentioned this on a previous show, which was Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage versus the Nasty Boys, where it ended up being that we had Mr. Perfect and Ric Flair attacking I can't remember now if it's the Warrior and the Nasty Boys attacking Savage or vice versa, and that was like a long beatdown segment. But that was kind of the main thing that stood out from that card for me.
Yeah, and then like the whole deal, wasn't it, with SummerSlam 92 is that whose corner is Mr. Perfect going to be in, and so there's a lot of intrigue around that match, and the fact, of course, that Savage and Warrior are going to face each other tomorrow night, you know. So I think that's quite interesting that they decided to do that. This card looks a lot more jobbery, though, on the whole. You've got matches like Tatanka versus Kato, Flair versus El Matador, Nails against Ken Wayne. I mean, Martel against Joey Maggs. These are all like jobber matches, basically. Kamala versus Burt Styles. Money Inc. defeat the Bushwhackers. I mean, it's basically a jobber match. And Bret Hart, in a non-title match, defeats Skinner. So
Skinner was on fumes by this point as well. So that was, you know, nothing, you know, memorable. And then the 93 one we'll finish up with. So this was Yokozuna, Jim Duggan. So this was pushing Yokozuna, obviously, still as the main foreign threat. And Luger was going after him. So it was kind of an obvious thing to put Jim Duggan in that match as like the American hero that was going to get squashed.
Absolutely. And Duggan had even been used in this role when Yokozuna first came in 92, and he's just doing it again, reheating Yokozuna for Lex. Razor Ramon defeats Blake Beverly.
In 93, summer of 93, Blake Beverly. So this was right at the end for him as well.
Yeah, I wonder where the brother was. It's weird, isn't it? Tatanka and the Smoking Guns defeat Barry Horowitz, Reno Riggins, and the Brooklyn Brawler. So there's a jobber dream team for you.
Wow.
Shawn Michaels with Diesel defeats Bob Backlund, IC title match. Did Backlund make a SummerSlam 93 card?
No, he wasn't on SummerSlam 93 at all.
He was in No Man's Land 93, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did the match at Royal Rumble 93, and I think he had the match. There was a match he had at WrestleMania 9, wasn't there? I can't remember. Who was he against now, WrestleMania 9? But it wasn't on, if memory serves me, the Coliseum video pay-per-view release. I'm going to have to look it up now. Bad audio now, guys. We have to kill some air while I'm looking at this.
Well, I'll just wrap up then. It's the final match here, apart from the Steiner Brothers versus Money Inc., is Marty Jannetty defeating Dwayne Gill. So there we go. So have you found the information here, Alan?
Yeah, I do remember, actually. My mind just went blank. He did work versus Razor Ramon, and it was a match that was on the show, I think. So I maybe get mixed up between that and the Steiner's Hedge Ring, because I think that may have not been the match that was on the actual pay-per-view release. The VHS release. So, yeah, I mean, that ties it all up with the question there. So there was other examples. Now we have pre-shows, and we have post-shows, and we have halftime shows. No, we don't, but there we go. We have a load of these shows nowadays, but at the time we didn't have them every single pay-per-view. There was never a King of the Ring spectacular in 93, for instance. So then, like we discussed, we're there to kind of heat up matches for Survivor Series at first, and they kind of did the same game with SummerSlam.
I kind of feel like the SummerSlam cards are way, way stronger than the Survivor Series ones. They just feel like more stacked, I guess. Would you agree?
Yes and no. I mean, we've got more jobbers in the SummerSlam ones, though, to be fair. But we have kind of some more memorable moments for me anyway in 92 and 93. But that was when I was watching these type of shows. This was, you know, kind of start of my fandom with the WWF. So, yeah, have you got anything else to add then on these kind of shows, Parv?
No, I think we're running long now, Alan. And we have a 1 hour promise on this show. We went very long with Hero last week. But we want to maintain our tightness, don't we, Alan? We don't want to overrun too much.
So, yeah, I mean, the sack's got to remain quite tight as well as bulging there. So
as per usual, when we overrun, that means we don't get WWF Magazine Corner. Sorry, guys.
Oh.
We'll have to wait till next week.
And it was a doozy as well, but there we go.
It was a great one. We'll have to remember to pull that one out next time. So just reiterate, what's this email address that you've set up?
Okay, it's lettersfromkayfabe@gmail.com. I've given Parv access to it as well. So we'll check that periodically when we notice the sacks, you know, getting a little bit less full. So you can send the questions in that way. You can do longer form questions and obviously on Twitter. But if you want to ask the questions on Twitter, just use the hashtag lettersfromkayfabe. We'll find those questions on there as well.
Great. Well, join us again next time on Letters from Kayfabe.
Adios.
Billy Red here once again, and I have standing by at this time with their comments, High Energy, Owen Hart, and the Birdman, Coco Beware.
Hey, you know what, fat boys? That's right, you nasty boys. You know why they call us High Energy? It's because we're moving, we're grooving, and we're always going to the top. The Birdman and the Rocket. You want a piece of High Energy? Come and find us. Tell them about it, Birdman.
High Energy!
That's what the world is talking about. High energy. I'm telling you, we got the Nasty Boys looking for high energy. We got DiBiase and the RS looking for high energy. That's what the World Wrestling Federation is all about. High energy. Isn't that right, Rocky?
That's right, you know, Birdman. I'll tell you something, Nasty Boys. You may be mean. You may be rough and tough. But don't sell high energy shorts, because we're going straight to the top.